And FM Madison.
You wake up to the 8 o'clock buzz to get the week started.
Now, we need the help of a good volunteer to run our on-air operations each Monday.
Sure, that means waking up a little earlier.
To get to the station around 7:30.
But that's why WORT has coffee.
So that you can start your week off right.
WORT is recruiting a volunteer to run the soundboard each week on Monday mornings from 7:30 to 9 a.m.
You'd run all on-air operations for our morning program, The 8 O'Clock Buzz with Brian Standing.
No experience is necessary, but a familiarity with computers and a strong sense of punctuality and reliability are preferred.
For details, call 608-256-2001 and ask to speak with Shali Pittman.
Or head online to WORTFM.org/volunteer to fill out our volunteer application.
Welcome to Worldview, your weekly source for news and analysis from around the world, right here on community-supported radio, WORT 89.9 FM.
Good evening, and welcome to the Sunday, March 24th edition of Worldview. I'm Lee Rowe, and I'm your host. Later in the program, we have a special guest, Sukumar Muralidharan. He's been on Worldview in the past, most recently talking about his book, The Nation and Its Citizens, Tales of Bondage and Belonging. And he's had a long career in academia, journalism, and letters, observing, reporting on, and talking about India and its politics. Gil Halstead and Amitabh Pal spoke to him last week to get his take on the most recent events and trends in the Indian elections set to begin on April 19th. But first, we have the news.
137 students abducted by gunmen from a school on March 7th from the town in Kaduna State in Nigeria earlier this month have been released unharmed days before a ransom deadline. Government spokesman Abdulaziz told Al Jazeera today, quote, "It took a lot of back-channel engagement to release the students abducted. It's the first mass kidnapping in Nigeria since 2021. Uba Sani, governor of the northwestern state of Kaduna, said in a statement, quote, "We thank all Nigerians who prayed fervently for the safe return of the school children. This is indeed a day of joy," unquote. He added, quote, "The Nigerian army also deserves special commendation for showing that with courage, determination, and commitment, criminal elements can be degraded and security restored in our communities," unquote. No further details were given.
Many of the 7 million registered voters in Senegal have gone to the polls today to elect a new president in the most wide-open election in the country's history. 17 candidates are vying to replace Macky Sall, who has been president for 12 years, the maximum allowed by Senegal's constitution. Votes are being counted after a peaceful day, although the lead-up to the election was rough. Only hours before the start of the presidential campaign on February 3rd for the February 25th election, Sall announced on TV that the election would be postponed due to a dispute between the National Assembly and the Constitutional Council over who could run for president. The day after Sall's televised speech, hundreds of Senegalese demonstrated in the capital, Dakar, where clashes broke out with police. On February 5th, lawmakers met and set December 15th as the new election date. And there were more demonstrations and accusations that Sall was to leave office by April 2nd, and he only wanted to extend his term until December. There were more demonstrations and 4 deaths. Finally, the Constitutional Council on February 15th delivered its verdict on the appeal of the election postponement, saying that it violated the Constitution. After much talk on March 7th, the President and the Council finally agreed to hold Senegal's election on March 24th, significantly shortening the campaign, and it began in earnest. There are a few favorites today, but who will be president is still unknown. Hundreds of election observers, foreign and domestic, said voting was heavy, but very calm and peaceful.
China's Ministry of Civil Affairs said there were 845,000 more marriages in China in 2023 than in 2022. That's 12.4% more. This is thought to be due to government campaigns to promote marriage in the country's latest attempt to target record low birth rates. China had falling birth rates for decades after imposing the controversial one-child policy in the 1980s to control overpopulation at the time. But then changes to the policy were introduced in 2015 and 2021 to try and boost population figures. But China's population fell for a second consecutive year in 2023, with a record low birth rate and deaths due to the COVID-19 pandemic. As marriage rates are closely tied to birth rates, some observers expect an uptick in marriages could lead to more babies. Earlier this month, China's Premier Li Qiang pledged that the government would work towards a, quote, birth-friendly society and promote long-term balanced population development, unquote. China's state planner also vowed in a report published in March to improve policies to boost birth rates by reducing the cost of childbirth, parenting, and education, and to also refine parental leave policies.
In September 2021, a month after the Taliban took control of Afghanistan, girls were first prevented from going to secondary school. Acting Deputy Education Minister Abdul Hakim Hamad told the BBC that girls would not be allowed to attend secondary school until a new education policy in line with Islamic and Afghan traditions was approved, which would be in time for the start of school in March 2022. Now, in March 2024, with the new start of school, girls have once again been disappointed. UNICEF estimates that some 330,000 girls should have started secondary school this month. And Afghan girls still held out hope that they would be able to continue, but when they went to take entrance exams, they were told they would not be able to return for the new term. Some girls are able to attend private classes run quietly in their neighborhoods and towns, and some have been able to follow courses online or on TV. But for most, the expense and time is not available for families that struggle to get enough to eat. Samira Hamidi, Amnesty International's regional campaigner, said the future for many of Afghanistan's girls is bleak, pointing to the fact that young girls are continuing to be married off when they reach puberty and are further endangered by the Taliban's rollback of laws designed to protect women in abusive marriages.
According to a report from the Washington-based nonprofit Freedom House released last week, Peru slumped from the rating of free in 2022 to partially free in 2023 and 2024 following the removal of former President Pedro Castillo in 2022. The report also traced the lingering effects of the government crackdown on protests and efforts to interfere with judicial independence and other oversight bodies. Will Freeman, the author of the report and a fellow for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, said, quote, all these regulatory bodies and independent branches of government used to have the possibility of opposing decisions by Congress, and now that possibility is really attenuated, unquote. He added that Peru saw the fourth largest drop in its Freedom House score of any country in the world, and that by the election in 2026, there may be no institutions that are not under the thumb of Congress.
Brazilian federal police filed charges against former President Jair Bolsonaro and others for defrauding public records to produce fake COVID-19 vaccination certificates. According to law enforcement authorities, false records were issued to Bolsonaro, his 13-year-old daughter, and other top administration officials. The former president was never transparent about his vaccination status while in office and sealed his records for 100 years in 2021. He was arguably the most prominent vaccine denier in the country, spreading misinformation about the vaccines, stating that they were experimental even after health agencies approved them, and falsely linking them to the development of AIDS. Supreme Court Justice Alexandre Moraes on Tuesday forwarded charges to the Federal Prosecution Office, which will decide whether to pursue the indictment of the former president. If convicted for all the crimes attributed to him in this case, he could face up to 15 years in prison.
The president of the Algerian Republic, Abdelmadjid Tebboune, said in a statement on Thursday that he decided to hold pre-presidential elections on September 7, 2024. His statement followed a meeting he chaired and was attended by the heads of the two chambers of parliament and the chief staff of the army. No reasons were announced to justify holding the elections early. Tebboune, who succeeded Abdelaziz Bouteflika on December 19, 2019, was elected for a five-year term and received 58% of the votes. His predecessor, Bouteflika, was forced to resign in 2019 under pressure from the army and the popular protest movement. Tebboune's five-year term ends next December, and he can run for a second and final term in accordance with the Algerian constitution, although he has not yet officially announced his candidacy. Last year, members of parliament urged him to run for a new term.
Egyptian authorities released the last two Qatari journalists that they were holding after a thaw in relations with Qatar. The two journalists, both Egyptians working for the Qatari Al Jazeera, had been detained pre-trial for 4 years. Relations between Egypt and Qatar deteriorated after President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, an army commander at the time, led the overthrow of President Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood in 2013, and el-Sisi assumed the presidency the following year. At the time, Egypt accused Al Jazeera News of being, quote, the mouthpiece of the Brotherhood, unquote, and arrested a number of its journalists. In 2017, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Bahrain boycotted Qatar over accusations of supporting terrorism. Qatar denied the accusation. In early 2021, Qatar and Egypt ended the dispute, reached an agreement, and rebuilt relations. Mona Gamal al-Din, wife of journalist Baha al-Din Ibrahi, indicated that she learned of the decision to release her husband on Wednesday after receiving a call from his lawyer. Mona, who has not seen her husband since December 2018 and last spoke to him by phone on the day of his arrest in February 2020, said that the decision to release them was unexpected. And those are our headlines for today. Now here's Gil with our first longer story.
It appears that chocolate will be more expensive than ever this year, as a shortage of cocoa beans has led to a near shutdown of processing plants in Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana, the two countries responsible for 60% of global production. Researchers say that the shortage is due to the environment, economics, and human activity. Changes in the environment have changed weather patterns in West Africa, which have contributed to cocoa growing problems, particularly swollen shoot virus disease. Ghana has lost hundreds of thousands of hectares of cocoa growing land. Problems with the economic cycle of cocoa production comes from the lack of fair compensation for sustainable cocoa production. Aging cocoa trees are more susceptible to disease and require high-cost maintenance. Historically, farmers abandon old farms and plant new trees in new forests, but now land is scarce. Human activity such as illegal mining has overtaken farms in Ghana. Farmers who lease their land to illegal miners have found that mining degrades the quality of the land, making it unsuitable for cocoa cultivation. In February, the Ghana Cocoa Board used a $200 million World Bank loan to rehabilitate plantations affected by the swollen shoot virus. The Ghana Cocoa Board has also established a task force to shield the farms from the harmful mining and has cooperated with police to stem the smuggling of cocoa to neighboring countries where payment in a stronger currency means more money. And at the start of the current harvest season in October, the producer price was raised in Ghana, although since harvests are smaller, farmers are not making more money. In Côte d'Ivoire, it appears the government is still assessing the situation and does benefit from numerous sustainability programs initiated by multinational corporations. The International Cocoa Organization, or ICCO, expects global cocoa production will fall by almost 11% this season. Already, chocolate makers have raised prices. U.S. retail stores charged 11.6% more for chocolate products last year compared with 2022. The ICCO expects global cocoa stocks to fall to their lowest in 45 years by the end of this season. Steve Wateridge, a world expert on cocoa at Tropical Research Services, said the market could post another deficit next season based on the severity of bean disease in West Africa. According to the ICCO, the market has not seen four successive years of deficit since the late 1960s.
Argentina's far-right president, Javier Milei, has been in office for 100 days after his election in December. When he entered office, expectations range from worst-case to best-case scenarios. Milei has confirmed the most alarmist expectations. He is impatient in forcing through reforms. He's inflammatory in his rhetoric toward both his critics and his partners, and is authoritarian in his attempts to run by decree. At a press conference to report on his first 100 days, Amnesty International Argentina said, quote, "Confrontation has become the official narrative to divert attention from real issues," unquote. Amnesty added that the president has used an infallible recipe of confrontation and disinformation, resulting in human rights setbacks. The organization showed that X, formerly known as Twitter, has been the government's preferred tool for these confrontations. Executive Secretary of Amnesty International Argentina, Marcia Belsky, said, quote, "The targets are the other branches of government, opposition leaders, journalists, artists, media and organizations. But when the person who leads the attacks is also the president of the country, this has silencing and menacing and intimidating effects that hinder freedom of speech," unquote. Milei has surprised many with the results of his economic shock therapy. His austerity measures have included slashing state spending, trimming subsidies, and adjusting the official exchange rate so it is more in line with the unofficial rate. For the first time in over a decade, he has given the government some breathing room in the form of a primary budget surplus based on serious reduction in pension payouts and an almost total halt to public works. The market's positive reactions are less of a surprise, as these are reforms market analysts like for economy like Argentina's, which has long suffered from government mismanagement and lack of fiscal discipline. His challenge now will be showing that he can tame inflation and fuel growth in the long term for these initial positive effects to translate into better conditions for the Argentine people. One main focus of the Amnesty International report was senior citizens who have been the most affected by the austerity measures. The report showed how their purchasing power had plummeted, and the press conference highlighted their subsequent loss of dignity. Politics and International Justice Director Santiago Juncal said, quote, "There's no more money shouldn't push us to a decision between recomposing their social security or letting senior citizens die," unquote. At the moment, Milei's approval rating remains above 50%, but Argentina's opposition won't hesitate to make his life difficult if his popularity wanes. That will likely paralyze Argentina's government, with its population once again paying the cost.
In the Jordan Valley, east of the occupied West Bank, the Israeli occupation forces confiscated 1,977 acres to expand the Yafit illegal settlement with hundreds of Jewish-only housing units and build an industrial area near the Palestinian village of Fasayil. Last year, the settlement directorate, headed by far-right Israeli finance minister Bezalel Smotrich, declared the land, quote-unquote, part of Israel. Last month, the settlement directorate confiscated 618 acres in the Ma'ale Adumim settlement area east of occupied Jerusalem and declared them, quote-unquote, state land. Peace Now Movement, a left-wing Israeli organization that monitors illegal settlement activity in the West Bank and occupied East Jerusalem, reported that approval for land grab and settlement construction plans in the West Bank were at an all-time high in the past year. The Palestinians seek to reestablish their country in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, with East Jerusalem as their capital as per the 1967 territorial borders. They see any land grab settlements as obstacles to peace and a continuation of Israeli occupation. The Palestinian authorities claim that Israel is taking advantage of the fact that the world is distracted by the war on Gaza and meanwhile continues, quote, stealing more land and furthering the illegal settlements, unquote. The Israeli Smotrich claimed, at a time when the country and the world are seeking to undermine our rights in Judea and Samaria and the country in general, we are pushing strategically forward settlement through hard work throughout the country, unquote. Judea and Samaria is a name used by the Israeli occupation as the biblical name for the central region of Palestine, known in Arabic as Samira and Jabal Nablus, or Mount Nablus. It is globally recognized as the West Bank and illegally occupied by Israel since 1967. Against the current government led by Benjamin Netanyahu, thousands of Israeli demonstrators held pictures of Israeli hostages held by Islamic Resistance Movement in Gaza and called for, an, quote, Israeli elections now, unquote. An Israeli captive in Gaza, Yajiv Bukhataf, 34, died last night due to shortages of medicine and food. There is no official number of hostages held by Hamas, and there are at least 9,100 Palestinian prisoners now held in Israeli jails.
And that's a wrap of news from around the world for Sunday, March 24th, 2024. I'm Lee Rowe.
And I'm Gil Halstead.
Sources we used to prepare today's stories were Afrique 21, Agence France-Presse, Al Arabiya, Al Jazeera, Anadolu, All Africa, The Associated Press, BBC, Buenos Aires Herald, The Brazilian Report, The Conversation Africa, France 24, Freedom House, The Guardian, The Independent, Middle East Monitor, Reuters, The UN News Service, World Food Program, and World Politics Review.
I'm your host, Gil Halstead, and I'm joined by my friend and colleague, Amitabh Pal, the Communications Director for the Freedom From Religion Foundation here in Madison, Wisconsin, and by our special guest for this feature, Sukumar Muralidharan, who joins us on Zoom from New Delhi. We're going to be talking about the political scene in India now as the country there gears up for elections that will take place before those here in the U.S., beginning in June. And I want to welcome back to Worldview, Sukumar. It's nice to talk with you again after a hiatus of, I guess it's been several months. So thanks so much for finding the time to talk with us.
Thank you so much. Yes, it has been several months, but good to be back.
And I want to turn it to Amit right now to remind our listeners who may have tuned into some of our previous conversations with Sukumar to give him a more formal introduction.
Yes, so Sukumar Muralidharan has had a stellar career as an academic and a journalist. He taught at the School of Journalism, OP Jindal Global University in Sonipat near Delhi. And over a career spanning three decades in the print media, he has worked on various areas such as science and technology, business, of course, politics and international affairs. He has been a visiting professor at the Jamia Millia Islamia. He completed a two-year fellowship with the Indian Institute of Advanced Studies, Simla. He has been a close observer of the Indian political scenario since the 1990s, often regarded as a decade of significant and far-reaching changes. He's the author of a number of books, and last time we had him on to speak with him about his latest book at the time called The Nation and Its Citizens. And we've been told Sukumar is working on a new book. It's such a delight, Sukumar, to have you on again after a gap to talk about what's happening in India right now and perhaps touch on your book too.
Thanks so much. Good to be back.
I wanted to start just with the most recent news that I've heard. We're recording on Thursday night here in Madison. And this morning, so just 3 days or so before this show will air, about the arrest of the chief minister of Delhi, Arvind Kejriwal, arrested by the India's Financial Crime Agency in connection with corruptions allegedly relating to the city's policy over alcohol sales. So what have you heard about that, and how does that fit into this run-up to the elections that's going on?
Well, this is a form of slow torture, you could call it, because this case has been going on for a year and a half. At least it's been talked about by the spokespersons of the ruling party and by the ministers for the last year and a half. The policy was introduced early in 2021 and discontinued soon afterwards because there were some difficulties with its implementation. But the whole case has been extremely opaque. Now, the deputy chief minister, the former deputy chief minister of Delhi, who's Mr. Kejriwal's long-time assistant, associate, Manish Sisodia, he was a former journalist himself. Manish Sisodia was arrested over a year back at the last bail hearing. Now, this is a situation in which even matters of bail go right up to the Supreme Court, right? Now, that's obviously a serious anomaly and a serious lacuna in our legal system.
And but, that's amazing. The Supreme Court is deciding, the Supreme Court in India decides on bail?
Yeah, well, you know, the trial courts have just lost complete autonomy. It's become a pretty pathetic situation, right, actually, because the trial courts have the complete authority to deal with these situations and to take a call on whether bail is warranted or not, but they invariably end up not exercising that authority. So it goes up to the High Court, and then the High Court is kind of intimidated and goes to the Supreme Court. So this is in October, and Manish Sisodia was assured that he wouldn't be given a quick trial, and that if he wasn't, he could approach the Supreme Court afresh to appeal for bail. Now that has happened, and in between, you had more innuendo floating around, and recently a close family member of the former chief minister of Telangana was arrested in connection with the same supposed scandal. And yesterday, of course, he had the arrest of Arvind Kejriwal. He's the second chief minister, first serving chief minister to be arrested. But just a few months back, you had the chief minister of Jharkhand, Mr. Soren, they issued a lookout notice for him. So he resigned and then they arrested him shortly afterwards. So, you know, so technically, although Arvind Kejriwal is the first chief minister to be arrested while in office, the last case was also very close to it. So this is, and the whole point is that there's absolutely no clarity about what the nature of the crime is. And the law is so broad and sweeping that you can be arrested for just about anything, I mean, on grounds of the most slender suspicion. So it's not a very good kind of prognosis for where this election season is going, particularly since it comes alongside allegations from the Congress party, the main opposition, that their bank accounts have been frozen. So, you know, without cash in the bank, how are you going to run a campaign? How are you going to even challenge this ruling party in the coming weeks and months?
So, Sukumar, for those of our listeners who aren't super familiar with the Indian political scene, can you just sketch out for them who the players are, what's at stake, and what issues are being debated in the elections to be held in a couple of months?
Yeah, but the elections will begin. The first round of voting will be on April 19th, and the last would be in the first week of June. And the votes will all be counted on June 4th. So the voting machines will all be unsealed, and they will begin to cough up their contents. And by the afternoon of June 4th, we'll have a fair idea of where we stand in terms of who the next government is going to be formed by. So, you know, it's kind of... It's another slow torture to have a 6-week long election process, but fortunately the counting of votes will be very quick. So that's a small kind of relief, small reassurance. But yeah, of course, the main party here is the Bharatiya Janata Party. But actually, it's all about one person, and that's the Prime Minister Narendra Modi, and he's become such a dominant figure over the last 10 years, and he's patented a style of politics that's uniquely his own. Like, you know, there's a book I have in front of me, which is called The Age of the Strong Man. It's written by a former Financial Times journalist, Gideon Rackman. And he's one of the case studies. Like, you know, it's a global phenomenon. And he's become one of those politicians who tap directly into a kind of polarized public mood and show very little respect for conventional niceties and institutions of politics. So it's become a kind of dictatorship by popular referendum. That's an appropriate kind of description. And in fact, there have been judgments and assessments by international think tanks, democracy watchdogs, which speak of India's transition over the last 10 years from the world's largest democracy to an elected autocracy. So this is really what Narendra Modi is about. Now the point is, he gets about in the first election, in 2014, he got 31% of the vote. In the last election, 2019, he got 37% of the vote, and he wins because the peculiarities of the Indian electoral system. He wins roughly like 55-60% of the seats because we have what's called a simple plurality, single-member, simple plurality system of election. You don't have to win a majority in each of the seats. You just need to win more than the nearest competitor. So that's the system we have. And of course, as long as the Congress was in power, the dominant party till the 1990s, that is, Congress, also the party of India's freedom movement, as long as the Congress was in power, they benefit from this because they used to win 2/3 of the seats. In Jawaharlal Nehru's time, the first prime minister's time, they win 2/3 of the seats with roughly 40-45% of the vote. So the difference today is that the Congress used to govern from the center, whereas the BJP has taken the politics to an extreme, and an extremely polarized environment that becomes deeply corrosive of our norms and institutions. So that's one side of the emerging political battle. The other side, of course, is the very broad assemblage of parties called the India Alliance. INDIA, it's an acronym. It's the name of the country. It's also an acronym for Indian National Democratic and Inclusive Alliance, right? So the India Alliance is, of course, anchored by the Congress, which is the single largest opposition party. The Congress had about 20% of the vote in the last election, but they won less than 10% of the seats, right? Because of the system that we have. But nonetheless, the Congress is the main opposition party and has a wide footprint all over the country. In about 200 out of the 543 seats, you have Congress as the main opposition to the BJP by the natural contest in these 200 seats. And if the Congress is able to win roughly half of those, it can give a good run for its money. But unfortunately, its success rate has been pretty dismal so far. The last time around, it won only about 10 or 12 out of these 200 seats. So it needs to increase its success rate, and it needs to ensure that the vote against the BJP does not get divided, and that it's consolidated under its symbol or under one of the alliance partners. So, of course, the India Alliance has not been very successful in terms of bringing everybody on board. Significant parties like the ruling party in West Bengal, in the state of West Bengal, the Trinamool Congress, as it's called. It's a breakaway faction of the Congress, but for some reason, breakaway factions from the Congo, they show the greatest aversion about striking electoral deals with it. So Mamata Banerjee has stayed out of the, she's the chief minister of West Bengal, very dominant figure in West Bengal politics. She stayed out of the India alliance. And similarly, in other states, you have, for instance, Mayawati, who's head of the Bahujan Samaj Party, which is the party of the Dalits, the excluded castes from the Hindu fold. She's also chosen to stay out of it. Although she doesn't win many seats, she has a substantial share of the votes in one of the main pivotal states, which is Uttar Pradesh, the largest state in the country. So how that vote is going to divide up and who's going to benefit from that is still an open question. So that's the kind of scenario we have. And of course, the BJP's major handicap at this moment is that it's already maxed out in its heartland. Its heartland is the Hindi-speaking region in the north of the country, north and central parts of the country. And in the west, it's already maxed out. It's won virtually everything. So it needs to expand into new areas. And this includes the south of the country, where its track record has been very poor so far, and the east, states like West Bengal, Orissa, and the northeast, the far northeast of the country. So that's the challenge that it faces. And Narendra Modi expectedly is spending a lot of time in the south. He's made five or six visits to Kerala, which is the southernmost state, and which is under a left government, where the BJP has never got more than single digits in terms of vote share. So he's made a number of visits there, which shows that he attaches a very high priority to that state. Tamil Nadu.
Right.
Tamil Nadu, neighboring state to Kerala, is also a focal of his attention this time. Yeah.
Well, I have actually two questions, but one just coming off of what you're just talking about the political divisions there and the challenges for both the opposition to the BJP and the BJP's the challenge facing it, as you say, to expand. But I'm trying to think about comparing it to the way the campaign season is panning out here in terms of an effort to demonize one side or the other. That's what I see anyway in our political scene here. I mean, is the main opponent, Trump, demonizing Biden and vice versa? I mean, does this happen in India as well between the BJP and then the other and the Congress party and other and their alliance parties in terms of how they're portraying the other side?
Oh, yes. There are, in recent times, there have been petitions filed in court for the prosecution of Rahul Gandhi, who is the leader of the Congress, for disrespecting Hindu religious sentiment. This is, okay. Of course, the courts have, some have taken note of it at the trial court level, some have dismissed. These have gone to high courts also in some cases. So there is that constant effort to portray one side as unmindful or disrespectful of the mainstream Indian, the mainstream, the faith of the vast majority of the country. And likewise, to also, see, the BJP's politics has been built upon, in some senses, exclusion of the religious minorities. So, that again is a subtle, actually not very subtle, sometimes right. Mr. Modi tries to be subtle, but his associates and his middle-level leadership shows no such subtlety. They come right out and attack the minority faiths as disloyal to the country, just by virtue of the faith that they observe. Now, this, of course, is completely antithetical to all the principles that Indian democracy is built upon, because we made a promise to everybody of equal citizenship, irrespective of personal faith or language or whatever else. And that has come under increasing stress in recent time. And the last two rounds of elections showed that the BJP could put together a ruling coalition while not getting any part of the minority votes, right? I mean, minority votes in all account for about 18-20%. The Muslim vote alone accounts for about 15%, right? So it's a substantial block. And so far, the Muslim vote has been kind of secure under the Congress party's kind of control, but got alienated because of the Congress party's own kind of waffling approach to principles of secularism and equality before the law. So the Muslim world got divided up. In some states, they entered into some kind of alliance with what are called the other backward classes, the intermediate castes under the Hindu caste hierarchy. And for a while, that succeeded in keeping off the BJP challenge in many of these states. But now the BJP has put together an alliance of forward, backward classes, and sections of the indigenous communities and the Dalits. And that gives them a brute majority, at least a plurality of votes that gives them a brute majority in parliament, right? So, so demonization is very much part of the game. And of course, there is a corresponding reaction on the other side also. Now, the other side attacks Mr. Modi and his party for being divisive and for being corrupt and for being vindictive and so on. So that's how the campaign is going to be played out in the next few months.
Well, Ahmed, maybe this is a good segue as we're talking about the minority politics there to go to this question about the new citizenship law. Could you talk a little bit about that, Ahmed, and frame it for us and get maybe we can get some response from Sukumar?
Absolutely. So people who follow India even a bit may remember that a few years ago there were large-scale protests till just the cusp of COVID over this new citizenship amendment law that would grant a pathway to refugees from certain neighboring countries who are not Muslim. And it was placed, I'm oversimplifying it, and it was placed on hold after the protests and then COVID happened. But now it's finally being implemented into law. So Sukumar, could you please talk to us about that and just the significance of the timing, etc., as to why now and what is the ruling government trying to achieve?
Yeah, well, the Citizenship Amendment Act is, in terms of the numbers involved, may not be very significant because the number of refugees from neighboring countries who belong to the minority faiths is not very large. But it's a symbolic kind of importance for the BJP because it wants to portray itself as the defender of the Hindu interests, right? I mean, this is specifically meant for refugees from religious persecution in three of our neighboring countries. In fact, one of them is not even a neighboring country because we don't have a land border with Afghanistan. But the three countries involved are Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Afghanistan. All three are Muslim majority countries. So the law applies to refugees from the minority faiths in all these three countries. So it covers the Hindus, Hindus, Sikhs, Christians, Buddhists, even Parsis, of which there are very few, and one other faith, I think it's the Jews. So it covers six faiths, but pointedly makes an omission of Muslims. Now, why is that significant? Because Indian citizenship law has never been premised upon religious identity, right? And in fact, we have an article of the Constitution, Article 14, which assures every person, not citizen, every person, of equal treatment under the law. So every person within the borders of India should theoretically, in accordance with the constitutional provision, be assured of equal treatment. So whether he's of one faith or the other, he or she should have that same level of protection. Now, there are some exceptions permitted if there is what's called a reasonable classification. Now, you can say that, this law strictly implemented would mean that you treat unequals equally, which means you perpetuate a situation of inequality. So we have introduced special provisions for people who've been disadvantaged by caste, for instance, right? So they can be treated differently from the others to ensure that their historical handicaps are overcome. So that's a reasonable classification. Now, this law makes unreasonable classification at several levels. Why does it only identify Muslim majority countries in the neighborhood, right? Why not Burma, Myanmar, right? Why not Burma, where there's a virtual state of civil war going on this time and a large-scale persecution of the Rohingya minority? The United Nations has identified the treatment of the Rohingya minority in Burma as bearing all the hallmarks of genocide, right? And so why aren't they given that protection under the law, right? The only reason is that they're Muslims, right? So, and Burma, like Afghanistan, is a neighboring country of India. So there is one kind of unreasonable classification there. And there are there's another level of unreasonable classification in the identification of refugees by religious faith or fast track to citizenship, right? So this has been under challenge in the Supreme Court, and virtually every constitutional expert believes that the Supreme Court, once it starts hearing this case, will throw it out. Will throw out the law as deeply offensive to our constitutional principles. But unfortunately, the Supreme Court has not heard it yet. And so in that kind of vacuum, in that hiatus, the government has gone ahead after 5 years of holding back. The government has gone ahead and notified it. And notified it, meaning it's framed the rules under which the laws will be implemented. Now, that's a necessary part of the implementation of any law, because the officials down the line need to know how they enforce its principles, right? So the rules have been notified now. And of course, some states have said that they will not implement it. They don't have the authority to do it, because citizenship is a matter for the central government, for the union, not the state governments. But they can direct the staff to say to not cooperate with the process. So, you know, it will be a form of civil disobedience. And as long as the Supreme Court does not rule on the matter, they have case to do it. Now, of course, the Supreme Court has also been petitioned now to impose a stay upon the implementation of the law. Whether they'll take it up, I think they have set a date for hearing the case. And what they will do on that day is, of course, something we cannot second guess at this time. But we are all hopeful that it'll do the right thing. We're all hopeful.
Since you're mentioning the Supreme Court, Sukumar, there have been two recent manifestations of the nexus between big business and money and politics in India, one of which the Supreme Court helped to bring to light, which is the whole electoral bond thing, and the other, which was very much in the public spotlight, and that's the pre-wedding festivities of the richest man in India, which was attended by Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, Rihanna was the chief musical guest. Can you just club these two together and talk about big money and politics in India and what they show us about the current state of the nexus between the two?
Yeah, well, Mr. Mukesh Ambani is the person you're talking about, and you're referring to his son's pre-wedding festivities at Jamnagar, which is a place where Ambani's Reliance Industries has one of the largest oil refineries in the world, right? And they are setting up a kind of wildlife park there and a sanctuary for orphaned elephants. And Mr. Ambani's son, Anant Ambani, is some kind of an animal lover. And obviously, he has the means to indulge that love. Although there are worries that he's running foul of wildlife conservation laws by transporting elephants from distant places to this place in Gujarat, where, you know, there's no native elephant population there. Now, Mr. Ambani is, of course, one of the industrialists who has benefited a lot from these last 10 years, who's grown fabulously in wealth, and the other is Mr. Gautam Adani. And these two have vastly multiplied their stock market valuations the last 10 years, and they vastly increased their personal wealth. And they're both from Mr. Narendra Modi's home state of Gujarat. And there are lots of valid suspicions that this regime is promoting a variety of crony capitalism. Now, the electoral bonds was a scheme introduced in the 2017 budget. It was introduced as a part of the budget, which means that it's a money bill. It's a which does not have to be approved by the upper house parliament. And the BJP at that time didn't have a majority in the upper house, so they were unsure about that. But it makes a significant change to several laws which are not strictly connected to the financial sector. Like, for instance, it makes a significant change to the Representation of the People Act. So that legislative maneuver was itself very suspect. And purported aim of the electoral bond scheme was transparency. Transparency in electoral funding, right? It empowered certain individuals and other companies and other entities to purchase what are called electoral bonds of in fixed denominations, which could go up to a crore of rupees, which is 10 million rupees, right? In multiple tranches, and donate these to particular companies. And these companies, of course, could encash those bonds and use them, the funds, for electoral purposes. So there was an assurance of anonymity, which would supposedly spare the donors from vindictive actions by other parties, right? If you're a donor to one party, you should not be subject to vindictive actions by the other parties. But as the Supreme Court found that during its hearings on the matter, again, the Supreme Court took this up after dilly-dallying for long, refusing to enforce a stay, and then allowing it to run for 5 years almost, allowing vast sums of money to be raised, finally came to it and finally heard the matter. And they said that this is not kind of anonymity that is safeguarded here. It's a selective kind of anonymity. Firstly, because the bank that floats these electoral bonds is controlled by the government. The central government is the single largest shareholder in this bank, the State Bank of India. And secondly, because as it emerged, all the bonds have a unique serial number, which kind of clearly associates who the buyer is and who the final beneficiary of it is, right? Yeah. So this is clearly a different way of extortion. And in fact, that's exactly what we have found, because after the Supreme Court held that the scheme was unconstitutional and in fact contrary to the norms of transparency in electoral funding, it was directed the State Bank of India to publish all details of it and make it known, and directed the Election Commission of India to publish all details on its website. Now, so the State Bank initially stonewalled it, saying that we don't have a way of matching donor with beneficiary. But it emerged that it was just a fiction. And, you know, once the Supreme Court insisted in a rare act of assertion against the political authorities, the Supreme Court insisted that State Bank should publish those details. They all came out, and now the clear nexus is established with political favors dispensed by BJP. For instance, a number of companies and other entities that were under investigation under tax laws were found soon afterwards to have contributed large sums of money to the BJP's electoral funds. So, and this is obviously of, you know, enormous public interest and public concern. A number of pharmaceutical companies, which were facing regulatory action and quality control inspections, including by the United States Food and Drug Administration, were found to have contributed sums of money and to have had these investigations called off. So there is a clear scent, a clear smell, a whiff of reasons here. And the mitigating circumstances have floated electoral bonds and raised funds through that instrumentality. The Congress party, out of the total volume of funds that were gathered under the electoral bonds, I think the BJP got 2/3. The Congress party got a small 20% share or something. Some of the regional parties like Trinamool Congress in West Bengal and the Dravidam Netra Kargam, the DMK in Tamil Nadu, have also raised significant sums of money. So the BJP could say that, you know, let he who is without sin cast first stop. But clearly, the scheme was theirs and they have been the principal beneficiary. So there is ample reason to believe that the scheme was introduced with the specific intent to corrupt the electoral process, right?
We have just about run out of time on today's interview. And so I wonder if we could just ask you, Sukumar, and thank you very much for joining us for this interview, to maybe just give some prognostication or some prediction about how this election may turn out in June and whether or not Mr. Modi will be holding on to power or not. Is there really a strong enough challenge that would change things?
Well, Mr. Modi is certainly very confident. He recently appeared before a conclave organized by a media company. Now, he's never held a media conference in the last 10 years, but he has addressed from a high podium. And, you know, he doesn't like the question, but he likes to declaim. So he announced from this platform that he'll be back at next year's event. It's an annual event, and he'll still be the prime minister. And he's been he's coined a new slogan for this election, which is Modi Ki Guarantee, which is that whenever he undertakes a commitment, he fulfills it. No, and his main talking points, the bragging rights that he claims, are firstly with respect to the temple, the consecration of the idol at Ayodhya, which is a long campaign that the BJP waged, and now they're building in the process of building a temple over the ruins of a mosque that was demolished in 1992. He presided over the consecration of the idol of that temple and dressed himself in robes of Hindu piety and saffron and so on, and was a conspicuous kind of participant. In fact, the main personality in that whole religious ceremony, which is most unseemly and most unusual for a prime minister of a secular republic. And in fact, the religious heads of the Hindu faith said that he has no business doing this because, it should be done by a religious personality. But that doesn't seem to have impacted the public mood. The public mood is still very, very kind of very enthused by his very conspicuous display of Hindu piety. And then there's the whole point with Jammu and Kashmir, the way he has done away with the autonomy that was guaranteed under the constitution for India's only Muslim majority state. And he claims also to have clamped down on the insurgency there, the militancy, but that's a questionable claim. There are various other disturbing events happening there. And of course, people also question why, if he has restored peace in Jammu and Kashmir, he is unwilling to hold elections there. Right. There was expectation that the elections to the state assembly would be held alongside the parliament election. That's not happening, and for reasons which are not yet apparent. So these are the electoral planks that he's going to fight on. The opposition is not in great shape. The opposition is in some disarray. The Congress party is suffering a hemorrhage of its middle-level leadership. The higher-level leadership is ensconced in positions of authority, but the middle-level leadership sees no upward mobility there, and they want to be participants in the process of patronage dispensation, and that only comes from being associated with the ruling party. So as of now, it doesn't look very, very bright for the opposition. But of course, sometimes hubris has a way of striking back, and sometimes you might find that this kind of arrogance may elicit a backlash among the voters. Who knows? It's all very uncertain at this time, but we're all waiting for 4th of June when we'll know the result.
Well, Sukumar Muralidharan, thank you so much for joining us here at Worldview for what I've found a really fascinating discussion of really what the political scene in India is like right now, and we look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Yes, you enlightened us so much, Sukumar, and yet there is so much to discuss. So thank you for coming on, and we'll have you again on soon.
All right. See you all.
And that's Worldview for this week. Thank you so much to Sukumar Muralidharan for joining us and for his expertise and his thoughts. We hope to talk with him again soon. And you can hear and listen to the interview about his book. We'll link to that when we post this interview on the WORT website. Thanks also to the Worldview Collective, especially to Gil Halstead and Buya Jemme, Sabia Tije, Maria Brunetta, and to WORT News and Public Affairs Director, Shali Pittman. And thank you for listening. And please join us next week for a new edition of Worldview here on your community-sponsored radio, WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org. And now, stay tuned for Salamat.
Worldview is written and produced by a collective of volunteers. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can also contact us here at this station if you're interested in joining our collective to bring world issues to the airwaves. Worldview can be heard every Sunday from 5 to 6 p.m. on WORT 89.9 FM.
Are you passionate about community music and local voices? I'm Jay Davis, and I'm thrilled to share an exciting opportunity with you.
I'm Tom Davis, a proud member of the programming committee at WORT. We're the heartbeat of Madison, shaping the airwaves with diverse, engaging, and community-driven content. But to keep the beats flowing, we need your help.
Since you're listening to WORT right now, you may be aware of this, but this is more than just a radio station. It's a platform for local expression, a hub for artists, and a stage for community voices. Join our programming committee and become a driving force behind what goes on our airwaves.
Whether you're into music, news, culture, or something entirely unique, we want your voice in the mix.
Visit our website at wortfm.org/programming-committee, or you can email me directly with j.davis@wortfm.org, and we can start the conversation.
WORT, where your voice matters.
من لم يمت بالسيف مات بغيره. تعددت الأسباب والموت واحد. That's what we say in Arabic.
Yeah, I got that part. So, translation. Whoever did not die by the sword will die by something else. The causes are many, but the death is the same. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another 1001st episode of Salamat.
That'll be 1001 Arabian shows.
Yes, 1001 shows.
Arabian shows.
Salamat is your weekly tour of Arab and Arab American news, culture, issues, music.